Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After weeks of speculation and concern over his ability to beat Donald Trump, President Biden has bowed out of the race. He wholeheartedly endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, and almost immediately, key Democrats across the country threw their support behind her as well. Some say this changes everything. Others aren't so sure. No question, it alters the dynamics of a race that would have pitted two elderly men against each other. Well, now youth has been injected into the campaign because even if Harris isn't ultimately the nominee of her party, and she will be, Democrats are guaranteed to run someone younger than Joe Biden or Donald Trump. A vice presidential running mate must also be chosen, and among the leading names being mentioned is that of our governor, Roy Cooper. He has developed what has been described as a close relationship with both Biden and Harris. Even Vice President Harris has publicly admitted her admiration for him.
It is so good to be back with so many incredible leaders, including my dear friend Roy Cooper. You know, Roy and I served together when I was Attorney General of California, and he was Attorney General of North Carolina. I've known him for almost two decades, and he is an extraordinary leader.
That's what she had to say in one of her many recent appearances in our state. What would Roy Cooper, being on the Democratic ticket, mean for down-ballot races here? What is this shakeup doing for fundraising nationally and for down-ballot races as well? And how might all of this impact the outcome of the election? And how much of a difference will this change make to the few undecided voters out there? Could it be enough to shift the race away from Trump and toward the Democrats? Steve Harrison is here. He's WFAE's political reporter. Colin Campbell also joins us. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter at WUNC. And Dr. Eric Heberleg is professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. We have other guests on the way. They're here now. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Morning. Good morning.
So, Eric, I'm going to begin with you. Nikki Haley told her supporters several months ago the first party to retire its 80-year-old candidate is going to be the party that wins this election. I know that things have changed since she said that, but is she right?
We'll see. I hope she didn't put money down on that. But one of the primary concerns about Biden as a Democratic candidate was his age, his mental agility. And now that he's withdrawn, that takes that concern off the table. So the question is whether the concern about the Democratic ticket is merely focused on Biden's mental issues or how much his administration's record, particularly in terms of inflation and immigration, will keep voters from gravitating to the Harris ticket instead.
Except the energy level yesterday when she met with her campaign team, which used to be the Biden campaign, the energy coming through the TV was palpable, not just from the crowd, but from her. It shifts the whole thing to a much, only a young person could pull that off, it seems to me.
Well, sure. And Biden never really did have a Biden groupie constituency with the Democratic Party. I mean, he had broad support. Many Democrats were satisfied with him, but he didn't have people, a base really, who were intensely committed. Harris has a greater potential to have people who are going to be motivated to work and turn out to vote to support her as an individual. So that definitely changes the dynamics of the race.
I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on this, but I think we need to explore it a little bit, and that is how Biden reached this decision. I mean, he's being hailed by Harris and many other pundits, et cetera, as being a true patriot because it's difficult to give up power and admit that you can't win, even though you're so dedicated to this and you have a sense of mission unaccomplished so far because he wanted four more years to finish what he started. But did he make this decision, do you think, because of family pressures, because of his own realization that there was no path to victory for him? Was it because of a pressure from Congress and the key Democrats in Congress? Was it pressure from donors who said, get out or there's no more money? Or was it a combination of all those things? And should that be the way things are done?
It's rarely only one thing. Clearly, he can read the polls, and polls over a long time have showed that age is a primary concern that voters had about him. The polls that his campaign provided him, particularly in swing states, since the debate, show his support dropping significantly in those states, which signaled to him that it'd be a very difficult task to win. He was certainly getting lots of pressure from other elected Democrats. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries were sending clear signals, both in private and eventually in public, once those private signals didn't seem to be working. So he was getting substantial feedback from lots of different areas that really all pushed him in the same direction. And as a successful politician, he can read those signals and realize his avenues for success were closing.
As Vice President,
if other elected Democrats don't have your back and can't go out there and make the claim that you're most qualified to be president, you don't have much of a chance of winning.
As Vice President Harris quickly emerged as the front runner to replace Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, the money began to flow in unbelievably. I think I've seen lots of different figures, but I believe it's hovering around $100 million in 24 to 48 hours worth of donations from small donors, mostly around the country, who seem to be enthusiastic about the prospect of a Harris race against Donald Trump. Act Blue on Saturday before Biden's announcement raised $7 million. On Sunday, they raised more than $100 million. What does this tell you, and will this filter down to down ballot races in North Carolina and across the country, Eric?
Well, it's certainly a good sign. It's a good start. It certainly shows that enthusiasm that you're talking about from the Democratic base. That's one ingredient in a successful campaign. Whether the enthusiasm also broadens out to the swing voters who are going to decide this election, particularly in the handful of swing states, is really the key. The resources help give her the ability to communicate that message to those voters. But if she has a message that those voters don't want to hear, having lots of money to tell them a message they don't want to hear isn't going to help.
Steve, every single Democratic governor in the country has endorsed Kamala Harris. I believe she clinched the nomination by getting support of the majority of the delegates to the upcoming Democratic National Convention. How unusual is that?
Well, I mean, I think everything about this process has been incredibly unusual. So I don't think there's really any precedent. It was interesting on Sunday afternoon when the president announced a little bit before 2, and then kind of watching in real time on social media, I was following the North Carolina delegation. And initially, everyone was just praising President Biden for his decision. I think Congresswoman Deborah Ross was the first to initially just come out in her initial statement, say, I'm with Kamala. And then once that happened, Governor Cooper did. And then it was this stampede of everyone kind of amending their posts to say, like, oh, yes, I back the vice president as well. I think in our delegation of the seven Democrats, only 2 have not come out in favor of Harris. That doesn't mean they're against her, but have not put out a statement. So it was interesting to watch it over a band of about 6 hours, how everyone kind of stampeded in her corner.
What have we heard from Jeff Jackson, who's running in the attorney general race against Dan Bishop?
So Jackson was one who his first statement on social media was very effusive toward Biden. And then a couple hours later, once everyone started falling in line with Vice President Harris, he did the same thing. That is his position. He is right in line with the rest of the party.
Colin, for an incumbent to drop out of the race this late in the race is unprecedented, and that's a word that we use far too often these days. But we have just over 100 days to go before Election Day, and the election actually begins in September in some states with early voting. They have just a short amount of time for the party to congeal around this candidate and for that candidate to mount a successful campaign. It may not be Harris, but it likely will be. And one thing that they have been lacking in the Democratic Party, I think, is enthusiasm for Joe Biden. And now they have energy, and it seems they have enthusiasm. Will that be enough to overcome the disruption that this decision has brought to the party and to the politics surrounding it?
I think that's the big question, or, you know, whether the enthusiasm gap changes. I think the challenge with this election, even if you switch candidates, so many people's political preferences are baked in. There's not that many undecided voters. The challenge for Democrats this whole election cycle has been sort of between do people come out and support Joe Biden, or does the couch win? Do people just choose that they're not enthusiastic about the Democratic candidates and they don't vote at all, and that it makes it that much more likely that Republicans had a really good year? This enthusiasm that we've seen just in the last day or so over Harris seems to indicate that Democrats may be back in, you know, getting excited about their candidate in ways they weren't a week ago. I mean, just a few days ago, all the Democrats were sort of at each other's throats over whether Biden should drop out. Some folks were very adamant that he should be staying in, that he was elected through the primary process. Others felt like, you know, he needed to jump out. And they were sort of all this infighting within the party. And now you have this sudden unity where everyone is coalescing behind Harris, which is sort of the opposite of the biggest fears about a Biden dropout, that it would result in this, you know, open convention in Chicago next month. And that, you know, there'd be all these different factions with different candidates trying to jump in there. And you'd have, you know, an even more divided party by the time you got to Election Day in November. Now it looks like you've got a party that's united and excited about their candidate. And whether that candidate can convince people in the middle is still the big question. Yeah. But certainly within the party base, there's a lot of enthusiasm.
Eric, one of the things that I think convinced Joe Biden not to run is that advisors told him there was no path to victory for him that they could find or demonstrate to him. And that means there was no way he was going to win enough electoral college votes in order to win, because it's all about the electoral college and winning key battleground states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, to some degree Georgia, us, North Carolina, Arizona. The Democratic candidate has to win X number of those states in order to win the Electoral College and therefore the election. What is their best path to getting these votes with Kamala Harris or whomever ends up being at the top of the ticket? Is it the candidate? Is it the messaging? Is it the vice presidential candidate they choose? What is it?
Well, certainly it's the message, and the candidate can't be separated from the message. That the presidency is really unique, and that there's a very strong personality component to it. So the fact that Kamala Harris hasn't run a real national race, she ran a short race for the Democratic nomination in 2020, she's really untested. So we'll see in the next few weeks and months how well she communicates her message, and how much she modifies her message from a message that Joe Biden would have delivered on behalf of her presidential candidacy. Biden's strategy was really to focus on the blue wall of kind of unionized states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Arguably, he has an advantage there over Harris. Harris might have more ability to draw in North Carolina or Georgia than Biden did. So those are the strategic decisions they'll have to make very quickly in terms of how they allocate her time and their advertising resources to try to make those plays.
And one of the key decisions that have to be made very quickly is that of vice president. You have to have a full ticket in order to run. And we're going to take a look at some of the vice presidential options that Kamala Harris or whomever sits atop the Democratic ticket will have to make. Later on in the program, we will hear from Drew Cromer, the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party, and Larry Shaheen, who is a Republican strategist, about all what all this means to both campaigns. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the switcheroo in the Democratic Party lineup, the apparent ascension of Kamala Harris to the presidential top of the presidential ticket because of Joe Biden dropping out. Steve Harrison is here. He's WFAE's political reporter. Colin Campbell is the Capitol Bureau Chief and a political reporter for WUNC Radio. And Dr. Eric Heberlig is professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. Steve, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has been mentioned several times, more than several times. He seems to be a front runner to be the vice presidential candidate if Harris ultimately heads the ticket. Meredith College political scientist David McLennan says, quote, the presence of Cooper on the Democratic ticket could put North Carolina into play, adding that the presence of a vice presidential candidate adds about 3 points to the party that the candidate for the party of the candidate in their home state, if I said that correctly. Would that hold true here? Would it matter?
You know, that's interesting, this idea that there's a 3 point, Bob. I was reading last night, getting ready for the show this morning, and you know, there was another report, another study I was reading from some political scientists, University of Dayton, saying, you know, they'd gone back to 1884 and they were saying zero impact, no negligible or no discernible impact, excuse me, from the vice presidential pick in a home state. You know, and if you look at the recent picks, the major parties and their vice presidential picks over the last 25 or 30 years, there hasn't been a lot of strategy behind it in terms of picking someone from a swing state to try and flip it. I guess maybe Paul Ryan in 2012 in Wisconsin, although they failed. You know, the ideas, I think we all talk a lot about the idea of a specific state to flip. I think that the bigger issue and the bigger thing people think about is just how the ticket works together, you know, the pair works together as opposed to flipping one state.
Paul Speck from WRAL, and I'm going to throw this to Colin because he's up in the Raleigh area. That's where WRAL is. He says that Cooper is a Democratic winner in a right-leaning state. He's never lost an election, meaning he has the magic sauce, Paul says. Harris has a relationship with him, at least she says she does, and he does too. And perhaps most importantly, he's available. There are other Democratic governors who have been mentioned, even a senator in Arizona who have been mentioned, but they all have more time on their terms, and Cooper is done December 31st. Will these things play a role in all this, Colin, do you think?
I think these are all considerations. You know, Harris wants somebody she knows she can work with. And as she mentioned in her recent speech, they worked together as attorneys general. When she was out in California, he was here in North Carolina. So they've known each other a long time. They're really good friends and they talk a lot. But I think the other thing they're looking at is sort of what does Roy Cooper do in North Carolina? North Carolina is a state. Democrats haven't been able to turn blue since 2008. They've tried and tried and tried and come up short the last couple election cycles. They have been trying again with the Biden-Harris campaign. Biden's been here a lot, Harris has been here a lot, hoping they can do that this year. I think they would, you know, potentially at least get a percentage point or two, maybe not the 3 percentage points that you mentioned in that study, if they pick Cooper, who has a track record in the state of doing significantly better than the Democratic Party presidential ticket. In 2020, Cooper got 76,000 more votes than Trump did, even though Trump ultimately carried the state. Cooper won his reelection bid by 4.5 percentage points here. Biden lost the state by 1.3%. That's a narrow margin. If you can get a little bit of that up, that could bring North Carolina into the blue column. And if North Carolina goes blue, then the path to victory for Donald Trump becomes very difficult. There's not another easy pattern of states that he can win to offset a loss in North Carolina. So I think that may be the most strategic argument in favor of Roy Cooper as a vice presidential pick.
So, Colin, I think we're having a little problem with your connection here. I don't know what's happened all of a sudden, but it's garbled a little bit. So we'll work on it on our end. You can work on it on yours as well. Eric, North Carolina has 16, if I'm right, electoral college votes. That's more than all but one of the other blue wall states that have to be won in order for the Democrats to win. Pennsylvania has 19, Michigan 15, Arizona 11, and Kentucky 8. We're in second place. So if Cooper were on the ticket, would he be of sufficient help in garnering the nearly the 270 electoral votes that are needed here? Or would Gretchen Whitmer from Michigan, who says she's not in the race, or Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro be the better choice?
Yeah, I'm of the opinion, if I were consulting with the candidates, I'd say choose someone who the presidential candidate really gets along with, who would be a good governing partner. The state is very much secondary. You want a candidate who's able to deliver the party message effectively and not screw things up. So when in 2004, when John Kerry was running for president, he picked North Carolina Senator John Edwards as his running mate. Didn't make much of a difference in North Carolina. Whereas contrast that to John McCain in 2008, picked Sarah Palin. She really excited the Republican base, but turned off a lot of other voters and probably was a major distraction to the message that, that McCain wanted to get out. Harris wants a candidate who can help her deliver the core message, help create that clear contrast between what Democrats are going to do and what a Trump administration is going to do, and not get in the way with lots of side controversies.
Well, Harris gets along, evidently, with Cooper. Cooper has never had a scandal, to the best of our knowledge. Cooper has a relationship. He seems to appeal to both rural North Carolina voters, because he's from down east, and urban North Carolina voters. All these things seem to push the needle toward him.
So one thing that he doesn't have is national security and foreign policy experience, but neither do most of the other governors. So that might be an area where Senator Kelly of Arizona might have an advantage, just because that gives him a qualification that's different from some of the other major competitors.
All of this, of course, Steve, is predicated on Harris being the Democrats' choice. And we are how certain are we, given what has happened in the last 2 days with all of the governors, all of the Democratic governors saying they back her, the majority of the delegates to the convention already saying they back her. There's going to be a vote in a couple of weeks before the convention so they can get the name of the nominee onto the ballot, I think, in Ohio. Is it a done deal?
Yeah, I would say 99.9% done deal. That would be my guess. And I was going to say one thing. You know, Eric had mentioned that when John Kerry picked Edwards of North Carolina back in 2004. And I was reading something recently how his campaign was talking about how he kind of regretted that pick, that he made it this kind of strategic decision to have a young person to balance the ticket, maybe to help with North Carolina. And then he wanted to pick Dick Gephardt from Missouri. They were friends, they got along, and he wishes he had done that. And so, you know, we've all talked about this idea. I mean, that Cooper's biggest strength may be that he and Kamala Harris get along well. I mean, that may be they just work together well. That may be the biggest thing in his favor.
And Colin, I'm going to trust that you're back with us. The clock is ticking on this vice presidential decision. How much time do you think she has to make that decision? And do you think it's already made?
You know, I think it may still be up in the air. My understanding is there was vetting materials requested from each of the potential kit picks the other day. And, you know, I think she wants to get this done fairly quickly. One of the telling things when Governor Cooper was on MSNBC talking about this yesterday was he suggested that this is not the week to talk about that, essentially, that this week should be about Harris herself. What that implied to me was that he's thinking next week may be the week. And I've seen some other reporting to that effect that they may want to get a pick out there next week so they can get geared up for the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and have the ticket set and not have us all speculating about who might it be.
The governor of Maryland has been mentioned as a possible candidate, and I cannot think of his name to save my life right now, but he's a black individual, he's a black man. Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan, has been rumored, although she says she's not in the running, and is, in fact, I decided to chair the Harris campaign, if I'm not mistaken, and she's a woman. Can you have two women, can you have two people of color on the ticket and win? Or is that just an antiquated theory?
You know, I think that's, you know, something that Democrats won't say out loud because it doesn't sound great, but it's certainly one of the reasons that most of the people that we're seeing in sort of heavy contention mentioned a lot happen to be white guys. And I think there's some sort of thought, you know, below the surface that, you know, you have to balance the ticket a little bit on that front, even though that's sort of feels a little antiquated, but I think that seems to be some of the conventional wisdom that's out there, and why you see folks like Roy Cooper, who is a much more traditional, old school Democratic politician, mentioned more often than Governor Wes Moore in Maryland and some of these other folks who have been mentioned as possible picks. They don't seem to be getting quite as much serious attention as like Cooper and, you know, Josh Shapiro up in Pennsylvania, Mark Kelly, the senator from Arizona. All of those guys have one thing in common, and it's demographics.
So let's talk about the Gretchen Whitmer, because she is a very popular governor. She, in Democratic circles, at least. There's Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, also popular. Mark Kelly, a senator from Arizona, a former astronaut. Andy Beshear, a young guy from Kentucky in a Republican state. He's a Democratic governor. All of these people, Eric, seem to have more name recognition nationally than Roy Cooper perhaps has. Would that be true? And is that a help or a hindrance for him to be relatively unknown to the people up in North Dakota, for instance?
I think all of them have very low name recognition nationally. So I don't think that'll make much of a difference at all. They'll be looking at it, you know, from the standpoint of the strategic considerations that we talked about in terms of you know, what demographic or biographical qualities that might be appealing to voters, what their ability is to appeal to certain constituencies, what their ability is to deliver the party message, what their ability is personally to work with Kamala Harris.
Drew Cromer is with us. He is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democrats. He's going to join us now to talk about all this from a Democratic perspective. And welcome to the program, Drew. Nice to have you with us. First, let me play you some of what Governor Roy Cooper said yesterday on MSNBC's Morning Joe program when he was asked about his chances as Kamala Harris's vice presidential choice.
Well, I appreciate people talking about me, but I think the focus right now needs to be on her this week. And she needs to concentrate on making sure that she secures this nomination and gets the campaign ready to go. The vice presidential conversation needs to occur later. I want to make sure that Kamala Harris wins. I'm going to work for her all over this country and do what I can to make sure we stop Donald Trump.
If North Carolinians have a dog in this race, Drew, and I think they probably do, particularly if they're Democrats, how do you feel about Roy Cooper as a possible presidential, vice presidential candidate on this ticket?
Yeah, and thanks for having me. I think that it would absolutely boost the Democratic turnout here in North Carolina. I think, as one of your guests mentioned earlier, Roy Cooper won North Carolina at the same time that Donald Trump won the state twice. And so he's got a lot of cross-party support. And we think that, you know, there's a large base of people in this state that love him and have seen him as a very effective governor despite everything in Raleigh.
How do Mecklenburg County, how do North Carolina Democrats feel about what just happened with President Biden's decision to not run and Kamala Harris's sudden surge to the forefront in this race?
Yeah, so it's hard to speak for everyone in the party. We are a big tent party here, but I can definitely say for myself, you know, I think it's a mixture of, you know, sadness, but also excitement. Sadness because, you know, President Biden has been such a great leader for our country and such a great president, has accomplished a lot in his time so far, but also a lot of excitement for the direction that we're headed in, for new faces, new people bringing new ideas into the party. I think, you know, just the level of grassroots energy that we're seeing right now is frankly unprecedented.
We have a comment from a person who identifies not as a Democrat or Republican or an independent. So I don't know what their political leaning is, but they say, I am absolutely disgusted. There is no open convention. She, being Kamala Harris, isn't earning her nomination. I'm saying it here in case no one else has. Have you heard that in Democratic circles, that she needs to do something more than simply be anointed?
I can't say that I've heard that one before, but I will say, you know, Vice President Harris, in her first remarks after President Biden's announcement, you know, she said that she was going to go earn the support of the party.
How does she do that? How does she do that at this point when she has the support of every Democratic governor and the majority of delegates?
Yeah, I mean, she's earned it now. I mean, she's now got...
Hold on. How has she earned it?
So the delegates, there's been a voting application that's been happening in the background where we've been able to go ahead and start saying whether or not we are in support of her. And she's already passed the threshold where she's got half of the delegates backing her. This is a party where, obviously we're here in the last hour, and we need to make sure that we've got our candidate going into the convention. But a lot of the delegates have already said, this is who we want. And, she's earned that support at this point.
She ran in the primary 4 years ago, and for whatever reason, did not connect with Democratic voters. And one pundit this morning writing in the Charlotte Observer, I think it was the Observer, could have been the New York Times, I don't remember, said that her campaign was hollow. She hadn't found an issue which matched up with her personality and with the people who would vote for her. Has she now? Does that concern you?
Yeah, so I think we're going to hear her campaign talk a lot more about issues, over the next 3 months. But I think what's important here is, the stakes are the same today as they were on, Sunday morning. We have a convicted felon running for president on one side. And on the other side, you've got someone who's incredibly experienced and is ready to prosecute the case against him. And I think that's what you're going to see play out over the next 3 months. Our party's going to offer our ideas for our country and how we would like to continue to move things forward. And at the same time, we're going to continue to show, the comparison between our candidate and what the other side is offering.
Well, you're talking about what's going to be a centerpiece of this candidacy if she wins, because she's a former prosecutor. But there's another problem on the other side, on your side. Annette on Facebook brings it up. She says, we must not skirt around the fact that all involved, from the vice president, Kamala Harris, to the press secretary, looked at the American people in the face, lied, and stated that he was healthy and competent, and then dumped him. I don't know if that'll be an issue, but it is right now. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, this was President Biden's choice, and I wouldn't characterize it as
His choice? Was it his choice?
I mean, I think so. At the end of the day, the president made the decision that the country would be, and the party, frankly, would be in a stronger position going into this election. We can't afford to lose this, and so he decided to take. Take a back seat here so that we could let another candidate run.
Drew Crummer is with us. He is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democrats. In a moment, we'll also hear from Republican operative Larry Shaheen. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the current shakeup in the Democratic Party with Joe Biden dropping out of the presidential race and Kamala Harris taking his place at the top of the ticket. She is, I think, safe to say now, the presumptive nominee, given that she has the support of all the Democratic governors and the majority of the Democratic delegates to the upcoming convention. Drew Crummer is with us for the moment. He's the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democrats. This was going to be a race between octogenarians, and a lot of young people weren't happy about it, although Donald Trump seems to be attracting a lot of young, particularly young men, to his side of the fence here. Drew, you're 27. What does this infusion of youth on the Democratic side mean for your party and for voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think it means that we've got a candidate that is closer in age, obviously, to my generation, people who... we've seen a lot of young people come out and be really excited about the vice president's candidacy. She had a lot of support in the primary from young people in particular. And I think it's the possibility of new ideas and a new vision that get people excited.
Both parties are pretty much dug in in their choices. If you're a Trump supporter, you are not going to change your mind about this. If you're a Democrat, you're probably going to go with the ticket no matter who tops the ticket. The whole thing is on who's in the middle. How do you attract those people to your side?
Yeah, so I think Vice President Harris will be able to carry forward, you know, the accomplishments that the administration's had. And we're going to be able to talk about the incredible things that President Biden has accomplished for us. I think at the end of the day, you know, when I have children, when I'm a little older, I want them to be able to admire and respect the kinds of values that my parents taught me. And I think we see a lot of that in Kamala Harris. And I think that the folks that are in the middle are looking for that sort of, you know, harmony. They're not looking for the divisive fighting that we're seeing right now coming from the other side.
Democrats have been focusing in recent months on the overturning of Roe and the Dobbs decision at the Supreme Court and other issues that are appeal to at least one major segment of the population, that is female voters. But now there's this thing called Project 2025 and the threat that Democrats say Donald Trump poses to democracy and that the Republican Party, in fact, because they're clearly behind him in lockstep, opposed to the success of democracy, the continuation of democracy. She came out yesterday and didn't talk about that to a great degree. She came out and she said she was a prosecutor. As a prosecutor, she went after predators, fraudsters, and cheaters. She said, I know Donald Trump's type. What's the message? What should be the message here? She clearly threw down that gauntlet, but there's so many different messages. What should be the message?
Yeah, I think the message that we're talking about is, you know, this November, the choice is simple. You've got a prosecutor going up against a felon. You know, it's experience going up against extremism. And, you know, I can't think of a more stark comparison. And I think you see the same thing happening here at the state level, you know, with the candidates running in the gubernatorial election. And, you know, I think the Democratic Party's got a better vision for this, and we've got better candidates, you know, bringing that forward.
Drew Cromer is the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democrats. Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it. We're going to switch over to the Republican side of the aisle for a moment here. Larry Shaheen is with us with a different perspective. He's a Republican strategist. You have described yourself, Larry, as an urban conservative. So before we talk about the Democrats, talk about the Republicans. As an urban conservative, is the GOP, as it is presently constituted, really conservative?
Well, I think that question kind of depends upon what the current definition of conservatism is. If the definition of conservatism is to conserve what has previously been, I think anybody who watched the RNC convention this last month would be surprised to see some of the speakers that are up there. Amber Rose, a union president. I think you've got a
Hulk
lot of
Hogan.
Hulk Hogan, Dana White. Let's be clear. Nothing about this election cycle is going to be like anything we've ever seen. And I think to a certain extent, the last time we saw this was 1968. I think Eric will chime in on this if he wants to. But the last time we saw a major party ditch its candidate the year of an election was the year that Lyndon Johnson got ran out by the Peaceniks and Hubert Humphrey was the nominee and they were in Chicago for their convention. I'm still curious as to whether or not that history is going to repeat itself because we're going to still have a lot of discussions about Palestine and Israel and whether or not those folks are going to have something to say at that convention.
But what about discussions about that? What about discussions about a party that chooses a convicted felon as their front runner, a man who has autocratic tendencies, a vice president who advocates for a nationwide abortion ban with no exceptions, and Project 2025, which he says, Trump says he doesn't know anything about, but that's simply not true because most of the people who put that together are from the Heritage Foundation or from his previous administration or are advising him now, and that document would change the nature of government and the country fundamentally.
let's work backwards from your list of topics. So Project 2025, I've never seen it, and I know a lot of other folks in my part of the world have never seen it. The Heritage Foundation and Kevin Roberts got entirely out over their skis, way too far over their skis. And I think when you hear President Trump say that, he acknowledges that he got way out over their skis. So do I think that even though some of the folks who wrote it may come from his administration and want to get reappointed, I think what you learn most about Trump is that Trump is loyal to those who were able to keep him in power. And I think to a certain extent, everyone knows that that was a flawed document from the beginning and probably shouldn't have been published because it's not true. And if I'm a Republican, I'm not happy with that document. So to a certain extent, I think his denial of that is something that ultimately was a good decision on his part. And I hope he follows through on it. Secondarily, when you're talking about nationwide abortion bans, you've seen Trump change the party's platform to talk about how that's not going to be something they're going to ask for. So you talk about the definition of conservatism, returning to your question, you see this change in their platform that has completely changed, not just that, but also the definition of marriage. The social conservative, it was the night of the long knives for the social conservatives on platform night at the convention. And it was to the thundering roar of applause. You saw that. Everyone saw that. It was wild. So ultimately, well, let's go back to the other two issues. I think they're linked. You're talking about felony, you're talking about Jan 6. There has been a long preaching since 2008 from a long period of time from both sides that the system's broken, right? Like the system's not working. They're being dictated to. People are being told what to do from a top-down level. We just had a party dump its nominee that went through a democratically elected primary process and impose another nominee. You yourself read that comment from two individuals who were upset about this. If I'm the Republicans today, that's what I'm talking about. And I'm not done talking about it until their convention's over. Because ultimately, the issue is when there's discussions about whether people believe that the system is broken and who's going to ultimately be able to speak for the people in 50 states, you've got New York and California essentially saying, yeah, this is who we want. And that's who they got. And we have no explanation for how that happened.
So let's talk about how this campaign will be conducted going forward on your side, because Donald Trump and I think the Republican Party was planning on running against Joe Biden and his characterization of Joe as Sleepy Joe and someone who couldn't, it wasn't up to snuff. Now you have Kamala Harris, who you cannot deny the energy level, you cannot deny the intelligence, you cannot deny her experience as a prosecutor, and you have a convicted felon at the top of your ticket. She's going to go after that. How do you run that campaign?
How do you run that campaign? It's simple. You say that it was politically motivated. You do. You say that the entire thing from, and even you play the clip.
But it's not true. I'm going to say it till I turn blue in the face. That's not true. It was not politically motivated. He's a criminal. He's a fraudster.
Andrew Cuomo disagrees with you, but that's neither here nor there. You talk about how you're going to run the race. You run the race making it about the rest of the country versus New York and California. Because that's what's going to happen, because that's what is happening. What is ultimately going to wind up happening is that you're going to see this race. And I'll tell you, if they do pick Roy Cooper, Mike, I'm going to give you a shout out. I really hope that somebody plays Desperate Vito at a rally, because good Lord, that would just be so. My wife loves that song, by the way. I don't know if you know. You've seen me in the crowd at Squawks, so you know that I love Squawks. But the Desperate Vito song that you put forward 2 years ago, well, it was perfect. It encapsulated Roy Cooper. And ultimately, I think when you're talking about how you're going to run this race, and I'm going to say this for both sides. Both sides need to say from the very beginning, and I know I'm going to get disagreed with on both sides, we need to run the race and we need to let the voters pick. We need to let the voters decide. And then we need to honor the result. That is, in my opinion, the most important thing we can say and do moving forward, no matter what, is that we have to let the voters pick and we have to honor that decision.
Following the assassination attempt on Donald Trump in Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago, everything, the tone ratcheted down on both sides for a while. The party convention, your party convention, took a mostly conciliatory approach. Even Trump's speech, The first 30 minutes of it was off script.
Then he went back
to normal. And since then, his statements that he's made to the press about Biden and in rally speeches are also back to normal. Just yesterday in a social media post, he called Harris dumb as a rock. Elsewhere, he's called her crazy. He'll be here at Bojangles Coliseum tomorrow night.
Wednesday.
So should it be business as usual, or should he either moderate his tone in this urban and mainly Democratic city, or should he ramp up the rhetoric and maintain this stream of middle school insults that he seems to gravitate toward?
Well, if I was the one advising the candidate, what I would advise them to do is say the policies of Joe Biden are the policies of Kamala Harris. And the policies of Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are the same. So if you're going to talk about those issues, talk about those issues. And if you're going to bring new controversial issues up, talk about the fact that Kamala Harris had to have known that this man was not competent or capable of running for president for the last 2 years, but even said that he was, even backed him to that point. So you've got issues you can talk about. Me personally, you, Mike, you've seen me on Twitter. Everybody on this panel has seen me on Twitter. They know I'm not a Donald Trump fan, right? They know that. But to a certain extent, if you're faced with one candidate and group of individuals who are going to impose unrealized taxes on unrealized gains, national rent control. You're talking about some real issues that have been introduced in the last couple of months that need to be discussed and debated, because we can talk about rhetoric all day long. But at the end of the day, this has to be about policy, and it has to be about how this is going to affect normal Americans, because this can't be an election for New York and California. It has to be an election for normal Americans and what's going to happen to normal Americans. And if we're not talking about normal Americans, what are we doing here? That's got to be the message, and it needs to stay the message.
Larry Shaheen is a Republican strategist. Thank you, Larry, for being with us this morning. I appreciate it very much. Steve,
always a pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. Steve Harrison is with us. He's WFAE News political reporter. Colin Campbell with WUNC in Chapel Hill in Raleigh. And Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte. Steve, let me come back to the down ballot races. It is said that this state's electorate has calcified in their political positions. Plus, the Republican legislature has gerrymandered many of the races to favor Republicans. Given that, how is the change at the top of the ticket on the Democratic side likely to impact the governor's race between Democrat Josh Stein and Republican Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson?
Well, I think it's if you are a someone just rang my doorbell, so give me a moment. I think for the Democrats running down ballot, this is a good sign. All the money raised is a good sign. I mean, the Democratic candidates in North Carolina, even before, were outraising their Republican opponents already. But yeah, I think that just the added enthusiasm is going to help, and positive sign for them.
Colin, you may have the same answer to this question. In the race for attorney general, it's a race that would probably go unnoticed by most voters were it not for the fact that we have two congressmen vying for this. We have one of the more liberal congressmen, or moderate to liberal congressman, Democrat Jeff Jackson, running against the most conservative congressman, Dan Bishop, the Republican. How is this change at the top of the Democratic ticket likely to impact that race?
Well, I think they'll be able to campaign, off of the presidential race more. This is going to be a lot more about prosecutors and law and order type stuff, which is what the attorney general does. We could potentially have, if Roy Cooper is the running mate, two former state attorney generals running for president. And so I think that would focus a lot more attention down the ballot on this AG race, which is probably going to be the most competitive. Other thing on turnout, I think, is sort of the demographic aspect of this. North Carolina last went blue in 2008 with Barack Obama, in part because there was a large turnout of black voters in this state. Harris has the potential to sort of energize that community more, increase turnout. And I think that helps like legislative races in northeastern North Carolina with a lot of majority black counties that have had low turnout in past cycles. This could be what makes the difference there.
There's a lot of unenthusiasm. That's a new phrase, unenthusiasm, about the two leading candidates in both parties up until this point. Eric, there was a desire for the torch to be passed to a new generation, to quote John Kennedy. And now it has been. Donald Trump has suddenly become the oldest person to run for president because Joe Biden is out of the race. And now you have, what is he now? He is, how old is he? 76?
78.
He's chosen a 39-year-old VP candidate. Harris is 59. Roy Cooper is 67. Does that make Roy Cooper too old for this race?
Well, I think age will become a lesser factor in the discussion now. I think most of the discussion of age was really related to Joe Biden's mental agility, not age per se. As many Democrats have noted, Trump is almost as old, but people were less concerned about it because he seems more energetic. But to follow up on the earlier discussion, I think the change in the ticket on the Democratic side does help down ballot candidates in North Carolina. Turnout is driven by the top of the ticket, by the presidential race. So the more Democrats are excited about Kamala Harris, the more they're likely to show up and vote for every other Democrat on the ticket in North Carolina. Likewise, if it makes North Carolina higher priority, the top of the ticket's going to spend more money here. More national Democratic super PACs are going to spend more money here. That helps the Democratic message get out. That helps Democratic voters and their allies get to the polls. That's going to lift all boats on the Democratic side. So I think that's good news for the Democrats.
And one thing that's certain about all of this is that the spotlight has shifted from the Republicans to the Democrats, at least today. Steve Harrison has been with us. He's WFAE News political reporter Colin Campbell from WUNC, Dr. Eric Heberle from UNC Charlotte, Drew Comer from the Mecklenburg County Democrats, and Larry Shaheen, Republican strategist.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.